Hello, and welcome to this week's Guardian Tech Weekly, the show that emerges like the good doctor himself to save the planet from substandard technology analysis, poor hardware reviewing, and Daleks. Today, we welcome back the elevator pitch as Jemima Kish takes a short break from her maternity leave to quiz Alexander Will, co-founder of Spoonfed, which is a company designed to deliver tailored event recommendation to London users. Do they have a head for heights as they make for the top floor? We also hear from Eric Kingdon, who is the snappily titled Senior Manager of Technology Marketing for Home Audio and Video at Sony Europe, who was lucky enough to be grilled by Charles on the state of the Blu-ray market.
Just like high-definition TV revolutionized your television viewing experience, Blu-ray will now revolutionize the way you enjoy your favorite movies, music, and games at home. Now, with Blu-ray Disc, you can own your favorite entertainment in full 1080p high definition, crystal clear surround sound, and seamless interactivity your home entertainment system deserves.
Lots of revolution-type noises there. And there were high hopes of world domination for Blu-ray 18 months ago, but with certain world events changing the economic landscape, we'll find out where they are now. My name's Susie Weezer, and joining me this week is the original Guardian Time Lord, Charles Arthur. Hello, Charles.
I'm not quite 903 years old.
That was not what I was saying. And joining us for the first time this week, Mercedes Buns. And ladies and gentlemen, it's her birthday. What a birthday treat for you. Welcome,
Thank
Mercedes.
You. Thank you.
So, as you may have gathered, this week I watched my first ever Doctor Who, and knock me down with a feather if it isn't really very good indeed. This makes David Tennant my favourite Doctor Who by default. But Charles, who's your favourite Doctor?
I think it's a toss-up between David Tennant and Chris Eccleston, who was just an incredible actor in the part. Though it has to be said, one of the best Doctor Who episodes of all is Blink, which barely features him at all.
I shall go and look that one up. Now I'm a fan. And Mercedes, are you a Doctor Who fan?
Well, a little bit. I come from Germany, and there Doctor Who's not that big, as it's pretty much a UK phenomenon. But I love to watch Torchwood.
I'll have to look that one up as well. I've got a lot of TV watching to do. Well, it's time to step into the technology TARDIS and deposit ourselves in an entirely new point in time and space. Incidentally, did you know the BBC chose a police box to disguise for the TARDIS to save budget on costly props? Well, with that Wikipedia-based gem, it's on with the show. Back in 2008, Blu-ray won the format war against HD DVD, with many people crediting Sony as a key player in the victory, thanks to the PlayStation 3 doubling as a Blu-ray player. Since then, there's been new features added, such as Blu-ray Live, and some pretty aggressive marketing around the discs. But despite all this, it hasn't managed to stamp out DVDs in the way it was perhaps expected to. Charles, you spoke to Eric Kingdon about this. What did he have to say about Blu-ray?
Well, I was interested to talk to him because in 2007, I got a presentation from Sony about their forecasts for how Blu-ray was going to sell. They had an interesting little PowerPoint with graphs against HD DVD. And I was interested to see how the reality was shaping up. So I asked Eric how things are going for Blu-ray.
Very well is the answer. Simple answer, both in hardware and software. If you look in terms of the number of units sold, if you look at the movie sales as such, the pre-recorded discs, by the end of 2009, we reckon that for Europe there'll be around 31 million sold. And that's a big increase on 2008. In actual fact, it's around a threefold increase on 2008. And in 2010, we're looking at probably doubling that again. If you go back a year again to 2008, the global sales of the format in terms of software were around 37.4 million, I think, to be exact. So when you think that Europe, within a space of a year, has come on stream to deliver that kind of volume, we're genuinely pretty pleased with the way the format's going.
And yet I had some a Sony presentation from mid-2007, which at that time was for Europe predicting software unit sales, that is the discs. For 2007, this is when it still thought it would be up against HD DVD. It was forecasting in 2007, 11.7 million, for 2008, 40 million, and for this year, for 2009, it was forecasting 85 million. That's a long way. There's a big, you know, difference between what's actually happened and that forecast. Where did it go wrong?
Well, I don't think it went wrong as such. I think that forecasts are in themselves an art form. And you can't always be totally correct in any forecast. The way the industry's developed over that period of time, we've had a lot of changes globally in terms of the economy. We've had other factors coming into play.
So but, what apart from the economy has come in?
Well, the other thing is, for instance, Blu-ray's governed by the amount of software availability. So how much studio content is available, the availability of manufacturing product and so on. And there are a lot of other factors that come into play when you're considering any projection. And of course, at the time, we had other things coming on stream, like the availability of silicon to develop the IC systems that drive the players, and the understanding of how we develop Java, for instance. That particular, if you like, package of software that Blu-ray uses to enable it to do lots of interactive things and so on.
Is it just down to the economy? Is it just down to people saying, well, you know, I've got an upscaling DVD player, I've got a normal DVD, it looks pretty good on my HDTV?
Well, that's a fair comment, but it's only 50% of the story. The other part of it is the actual sound quality, because the sound capability of the format is way in advance of anything that DVD video could offer. Not just in terms of multi-channel, but the actual quality of each channel's capability. It's really, really remarkable when you actually get a proper demonstration of it. As a format for DVD video, I mean, we still project that DVD video is going to be around for quite some time to come. It's going to take time for the Blu-ray system to completely overtake it. I mean, you know, the range of pricing that you can pay for a DVD video, and you can get DVD videos with newspapers now. It's a fact of life, if you like. It's part of our lifestyle now, DVD video. No, it's going to be around for quite some time.
One can see that the economy, having tanked as it has, has made people think much harder about whether they're going to spend on buying a comparatively more expensive Blu-ray player. They're going to think more carefully about whether they then want to spend comparatively more for Blu-ray disc. And also, isn't there a big effect from things like the iPlayer and online video? The rise of YouTube and the iPlayer surely meant that people who would be perhaps watching video at home from a disc are instead watching it off the internet.
Very fair comment. There are a lot of things really technically to consider. The speed of connection, how long it takes to download that content, can you actually get the same level of sound quality with the associated movie that you want to watch?
Do people really care about sound quality?
I think they do, very much so.
So many people listen to MP3s where the sound quality is a long way short.
Yeah, so do I.
But Spotify is enormously popular, even though it's not a sound quality that's comparable with a CD.
And you're absolutely right. The name of the game is providing different options for different people for different applications. You should have that option available choice. If you want the best quality, if you want to move as near as you can to having a theatrical experience at home, and with a sound quality level that in technical terms is actually better than what a cinema can offer, then Blu-ray can do that for you.
But the argument of quality versus less expensive is a hard one to win these days. I mean, quality is not a mass market proposition.
You have an argument in that point, But Blu-ray isn't just about pure quality. With Blu-ray, it's the actual level of picture quality. It's the fact you can play it on a large screen to a level of performance and quality you simply cannot achieve with DVD video.
It's like just a quality argument to me.
It's more about the experience and the emotional impact, how much more you get intensely involved with the action or the film itself and the associated sound. Plus, you've got things like BD Live, you've got the ability to store masses of content, and most importantly, it paves the way for the introduction of 3D in the home.
So you're saying that Blu-ray is going to support 3D?
Blu-ray, at the moment, the BDA, which is the Blu-ray Disc Association, we're actually looking at the agreement of 3D and how we can use it for Blu-ray. What Blu-ray will do is it will allow you to enjoy a full high-definition version of 3D. And that's really, that you do have to see. We think that 2010 will be the year for it. Going back to your quality comment, I think that it's all a question of how much the user gets from a format. We're all about trying to deliver a better and better sound quality, better and better picture quality, more user features. I think when you add up all of those as a package, it's, to be honest with you, pretty irresistible.
What sort of price do you think that Blu-ray players and Blu-ray discs would have to hit for people to be saying, actually, you know, this is a price that I can accept?
If you look at a current player like the 360, which is our entry-level model, and it outperforms a model that was more expensive and higher up the range just about a year ago.
But, for example, I can buy an upscaling DVD player for about £100.
Yeah.
Are there any Blu-ray players that are approaching that sort of price, or are they still at the £200, £250?
Well, I think you've got to... I think if you look within the market, if you search the web, you will find them getting quite close to those kinds of figures in some cases.
What's the best you've seen?
I've seen it sold for around £200 or even less than £200.
And in terms of the sales of the discs themselves, what do you think would be the sort of retail price that would, again, would drive an inflection point where people suddenly say, oh, well, that's, you know, I'll just stick one in the shopping trolley? Right.
I wouldn't like to give you an answer on that, because I think it depends upon what the movie is, what the content is, what the whole package is. So I think you're going to see a big diversity in pricing for some time to come, according to what the content is, according to what the movie is, what the added extras are, the features, whether it's live, interactive, and so on.
That was Charles Arthur there talking to Eric Kingdon from Sony Europe. Now, Charles, Eric spoke quite a lot about the quality that they were pushing with Blu-ray. But is this enough to make people buy, in your opinion? Do they need to do more about the pricing structure, do you think?
If you want to hit the mass market, you have to go for price. The quality argument is one that people try to upsell people onto, but it never worked for Super Audio CD, which was a sort of enhanced audio format that Sony tried to sell. Never worked for DVD audio, which was one that was also meant to be an enhanced audio quality thing. You know, people went for MP3. Quality is just not a mass market proposition.
Okay. Mercedes, what about the format itself? I mean, they were talked there about when it's going to stamp out DVD, but do you think it's got a lifespan as a format when people like YouTube and the iPlayer are already streaming in high definition?
I also think humans are lazy people and they don't like to go out and go for a product if they can have it directly on the computer.
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually. It's actually leaving the front door, isn't it? Charles, the major selling point is undoubtedly the quality, both the picture and the sound. And they're hitting this pricing within a recession. Is it a strategy that's going to work?
Well, I mean, it was quite obvious there that the numbers were down compared to their projections. They'd been projecting enormous numbers, you know, back in 2007 when it looked like everything was rosy. They were projecting these sort of 85 million numbers. The reality is less than half of that. So I think that the reality is they have to look for much lower prices for both the discs and the players before they're really going to get any benefit out of it.
What about this talk of 2010 being the year of 3D high definition? Is this looking realistic?
I think it's over-optimistic to me. You can't really get people to replace the Blu-ray players they bought a year ago and hope that they're going to get them for 3D. I mean, 3D is fantastic. I love it in the cinema. But getting into the home, that's a tough one. Mm. Tough one.
And what do you think about, you know, YouTube and iPlayer? YouTube announced that they were going to be streaming in 1080p now.
Nicholas Carr has done an interesting piece in the New York Times magazine last weekend about how he bought a new Blu-ray player. It hooked onto his wireless network pretty much immediately, and he found himself just watching Netflix films, YouTube videos, all those sorts of things, rather than watching Blu-ray discs. And he was really, you know, making the point that I'm sorry, but you know, the internet is much more interesting these days, and Nick Carr is not what you would call your average sort of YouTube user.
Interesting. So it's kind of Blu-ray players kind of a means to an end. It doesn't necessarily involve Blu-ray discs. Mm. Frightening for them. On Twitter, Nina Evans defied the laws of times by already tweeting us about our Blu-ray feature, discussing whether it was worth the investment. She said, "The quality is superb on Blu-ray, but I prefer the wider selection of stuff available on DVD. The content is more important," which I think is a pretty good point. Well, there's been more going on in the world of high-definition hijinks. There's a roundup here of the latest tech headlines.
SciStar, the Florida-based company that was making Apple clones based on PC hardware, has lost all of its claims against the computer giant in a legal victory that's an important ruling against would-be clone makers. The judge ruled that Apple's end-user license agreement on its Mac OS X software is legal and can be interpreted broadly, which would mean when the agreement says you can't install it on non-Mac hardware, that is the case, and it can't be argued that this is limiting to you. One of the best-kept literary secrets of the decade has been revealed, as 34-year-old scientist Dr. Brooke Magnanti has announced she was the writer masquerading as call girl Belle de Jour. The author behind the best-selling books, detailing her secret life as a prostitute, decided to come out saying she has no regrets about the 14 months she spent as a prostitute. It follows the outing of the award-winning police blogger Nightjack and the sex writer Abby Lee. Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2 sold 1.23 million units in its first day, more than double the previous record set by Grand Theft Auto 4 in April 2008. That's according to figures released by the Game Software Association, ELSPA. The game is estimated to have grossed around £47 million in the UK alone, easily beating the amount made by GTA 4, which grossed £27.2 million. And the Wiltshire town of Swindon is to become the first in the UK to provide free wireless internet access for 186,000 citizens. The £1 million project will be funded by a mixture of public and private money, and it's hoped the scheme will break into profit, with residents subscribing to faster, paid-for access above the free service.
So, SciStar have lost their case when they were running Mac OS X on non-Apple hardware. Was it ever going to go any other way?
There was just the faintest chance that they might have been able to get the end-user license agreement, which is the thing that you sort of click through all the time and everything, that they might have been able to argue that they weren't bound by it, that having bought a copy from Apple, they were free to do with it what they wanted to do. But Apple made the case that they were, in effect, altering the way that the license was used, and that Apple's license did not allow them to reconfigure the software in the way that it was being done. And the judge in the case stuck with Apple on that and said it's indeed the case. The end user license agreement, where it says you can't run this on Apple hardware, that is actually what it means. It's called Rule of First Doctrine, I think. So once that was done, then SciStar really didn't have a hope. And it has to be said that they hadn't presented their legal case very well. It is a bit of a... this is one of those David versus Goliaths where actually David gets stomped on.
Ouch. Okay, what about Belle de Jour? She outed herself as the sex blogger behind... Die with London Call Girl. There's been kind of rumours, things flying about. Is it definitely her?
Oh, it's definitely her. Yes, I'm very sure about that. Certainly the person who wrote the blog, and I've been making some calls and talking to people today, and they are also very convinced that she was indeed working as a high-class prostitute in that sort of period. There has to be said she wasn't doing it for that long. The blog lasted a lot more, and the books lasted a lot longer than the actual occupation, if you want to put it that way.
She's doing well to bring attention to the funding issues for medical researchers, because that's why she got into it in the first place. Is this just a fabulous PR campaign by someone desperate for funding?
She said, I think, at one stage that she was in a brothel where everyone else was studying for a PhD or something, which I find quite remarkable, unless it was a very, very particular sort of escort agency.
Mercedes, what about you? These anonymous bloggers who self-out themselves, has she timed it just right? Do you know the reason behind why she's outed herself?
I don't know. I think they're an interesting phenomenon on the internet. It seems to be that, like, we love to read that stuff because we think our life is quite boring, and we would like to read about lives that are really, like, a little bit more on the edge. And then most of the time when the truth comes out and everything's not as hot as we thought it was, we get a little bit... Well, we don't really like that, so...
So she might not be as interesting now she's not anonymous.
Yeah, that's...
Yeah, interesting. Well, you can find out more about both of these stories and the latest tech headlines on the Guardian Technology homepage. Just go to guardian.co.uk/technology for more. Jemima's been busy on maternity leave introducing Gigantababy to the world. But she took a brief break from this to step back into the startup elevator for the elevator pitch. She spoke to Alexandra Will, the co-founder of Spoonfed, to find out the cut of the company jib.
Welcome to Elevator Pitch.
Ground floor. Please mind the doors. going up.
So, who are you and what's your company?
Hi, I'm Alex Will and I'm the co-founder and co-CEO of Spoonfed.
Okay, so your business in a nutshell.
Spoonfed, in a nutshell, is a 21st century version of Time Out. So the question that we answer is what's on events in London. We have a publication platform that allows us to aggregate all the events that are in London. And then we have a small team of editors that polish that so that you get good editorial content written by us that's trusted and properly categorised.
First floor.
How many full-time staff do you employ?
Currently there are 12 of us and a small army of interns. We're based just north of Old Street.
So how are you funded then?
We're currently angel funded and are currently finishing another angel round.
How do you make money?
Obviously in the current climate, things like advertising and commissions from ticket sales are part of our business, but they don't form the core part of it. The primary revenue stream that Spoonfed's been developing is a product called Bullseye. And what it does is it's basically a tool that allows event owners to effectively market their events online. So we've built them a system of tools that makes them be able to manage their digital footprint, do their customer relationship management, and do that all from one place.
Second floor.
How are personalization and recommendation part of your business?
You can set the locations you want to go out in, be that Shoreditch or Notting Hill or the whole of Southeast London, and you can set preferences for entertainment. So you might like stand-up or comedians that have been seen on TV or jazz, and we try to work hard to have deep categorization, so it's not rock, pop, and jazz as one category, because they're not the same thing. As our user base grows, we're going to work on the kind of algorithm side for the recommendations, because we didn't want to spend time building a system without enough data. And we find that a very important thing is the more people use the site, the easier it is for us to start predicting what you might like.
How many users do you have now, and what's your target within 12 months?
Currently, we have a little over 100,000 unique users. And for the end of this, for 12 months from now, we'd like to be on somewhere around 1 million unique users. Having said that, we know it takes time, and hence we have a focus of a revenue stream which actually drives money off-site.
Third floor.
Which tech businesses or web thinkers are the ones to watch?
One that I met in the States that I really like, that I haven't seen much of here, something called Apture. You can hover over, let's say, a football club link, and you can then immediately see the Wikipedia entry or a video that goes with it without having to leave the page. And it's a simple little line of code that can be incorporated in a web page, and there's no implementation required, and it automatically sucks all the data up. So I would definitely recommend having a look at Apture for publishers.
What's the weirdest business experience you've had so far?
Early on, when Henry, my business partner, and I started Spoonfed and we didn't have any money to pay people, Henry's a fantastic chef, so we put an ad up on Gumtree and said, you know, will you work for cooked lunches? And we did that for about 6 months in my basement, every day cooking 3-course meals. And you'll be surprised what people will do for good food.
So in 5 years' time, where would you like to be?
In 5 years, I'd like the company to be in all the major European cities across the UK and also in the United States in, you know, the 5 to 10 major urban metropolises, because that's where Spoonfed really works, in a vibrant city where there's a lot going on and you often feel like you miss out on really interesting things just because life gets a bit busy.
Fifth floor. Doors opening.
That was Jemima Kish there talking to Alexander Will, co-founder of Spoonfed. Now, I was surprised to see that Time Out, who are presumably one of their key competitors, doesn't actually have an iPhone app, while Spoonfed does have a free app. Mercedes, can you be a recommendation service nowadays and not offer one, do you think?
No, no way, you can't, I think. We don't want to wait anymore around or like plan our evening on the computer before we actually go out. We want the information where we are. But I think Time Out's pretty like late with the internet anyway.
They do seem to be lagging. So it's a crowded marketplace out there for personalised services. You know, there's a lot going on. What does a company need, do you think, to set it apart?
Well, people need to have more time that they can use their recommendations, first of all. Well, otherwise, personalised services, personally, I like them more the other way around. If a company is able to gather what my friends are doing and then throws that at me. I'm not such a big fan of, like, if I'm interested in sports topics and then I get all the sports recommendations. But we will see. I'll definitely have a look at it.
Yeah, you want to know where your friends are and what they're doing too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Charles, what about you? What do you think of the service? Anything that was flagged to you?
The thing that made my antennae quiver was the mention of having the 12 editors working on content, because that to me is just one of those slightly dangerous things, because as you get more things that you're trying to edit and stuff, they just fall behind, and it doesn't scale. You know, it might work for a certain number of users, but if you get to 1 million users, is that really going to scale? If you get to, you know, 1,000 subjects, you're not going to be able to do that. You're going to have an organization that's going to be bigger than, you know, any of the national newspapers trying to do recommendation services. So I think that they're going to hit a point at some stage where it just stops working like that, and they'll have to rethink.
We'll have to shove them back in the elevator at that point to see what their answers are. Now it's time to turn the show over to you as we cast an eye over the blogs. Charles, what's going on the tech blogs?
Well, mostly people are being really grumpy, I have to say. It's been a week full of really big fight-ups on the tech blog and stuff like that. But I did manage to find at least one useful and sort of vaguely entertaining comment, which is from Zixi, who was posting on the Apple and SciStar piece, where people had sort of got rather confused in the comments about what constitutes antitrust and what doesn't. And Zixi said, one thing I find endlessly depressing and is a common theme over on Slashdot 2 is the number of people who have absolutely no idea about either antitrust or anti-tying legislation, and therefore bandy them about in the context of OS X as though they have some sort of relevance. It's perfectly legal to tie products so long as you don't have significant, indeed overwhelming, market power to the power that you'd be a target for antitrust legislation. Apple represents 5% or so of the computer market, and if they refuse to sell you an iMac without you also purchasing a clown suit and agreeing to wear it to work on the first Monday of each month, they are perfectly entitled to do that. SciStar tried the argument in the most silly form that Apple have a monopoly of OS X, so the relevant market to be examined is not that for a small computer operating systems, but for OS X. That's ludicrous. It implies that Madonna operates a monopoly of being Madonna, and that J.K. Rowling should be broken up into separate companies for each of her books.
When in doubt, throw in a Madonna reference, I say.
Yes, absolutely. I like the idea of breaking up J.K. Rowling. That's an intriguing one.
Mercedes, what's been going on the digital content blog?
Well, we had this nice discussion this week. What happens if your boss follows you on Twitter, if it's invading your privacy, or if it's okay, because tweets are public anyway, most of them are. And we had this one user that really pointed out in a very short comment what it was all about. He said, and his nice name was Darkblade, "My boss is one of my Facebook friends. This is a good thing, as it stops me from posting anything stupid about work on there."
That's perfect. So you need to think of your boss, probably also like your mother or something like that. Would she want to read it? We received an email from Sandy Legg admonishing us, or in actual fact Bobby, for inflating the price of gaming in the UK. Last week he said you'd be lucky to get much change from £100 when buying a game. However, as Sandy writes, there are plenty of games touching the £50 mark, there are very, very few being sold at more than that, and virtually none once you take out games such as Guitar Hero or the Rock Band franchise, and now DJ Hero. It was only today that I bought Call of Duty 2 Modern Warfare 2 for £26 from Sainsbury's. This leaves me with plenty of change from £100. And she's quite right too. We think Bobby may have put the decimal in the wrong place and didn't carry the one when he was doing the maths. Meanwhile, we've had photos for our most ludicrous tech setup, Flickr Pool, which we'll be sharing with you next week, which means there's still time for you to photograph yours. And here's a free tip. You get extra points for annotating them. And of course, as always, we love getting your 140-character-based feedback on Twitter. Just at us on @GuardianTW. And we also want your slightly longer messages via Facebook. You can find links to all of this on guardian.co.uk/techweekly. And with that, we arrive at the end of this week's show. Thanks to Eric Kingdon of Sony Europe and Alexander Will from SpoonFed for joining us. Before we go, since I've only just cottoned on to Doctor Who, Mercedes, what's your recommendation for essential geek viewing?
I don't know. I'm looking forward to V, actually. Might be cool, might be pretty mainstream, I don't know, but I'm definitely looking forward to it.
One to watch. Charles, what do you think I should not be missing?
Have you seen Blake 7?
No. Right, it's on the list. Next week, we'll be putting a whopping 12-megapixel camera phone through its paces and chatting to the global CTO of Hewlett-Packard about all things computery. But until next Tuesday, I'm Susie Weezer.